So my name is Alan Grossman. I direct the Postgraduate Center in DIT, which was a center for transcultural research and media practice. It's changed its name to a center for socially engaged practice-based research. Essentially, it's a postgraduate center, so I spend much of my time supervising PhD projects, traditional PhDs, and what we call practice-based PhDs. I'm only sharing these comments with you so you know where I'm coming from. Now, we have two presentations today. There was going to be three. Unfortunately, David Tienen is unable to join us. We have an hour and a half. I imagine you're going to present between 15 to 20 minutes, is that correct? So there's a lot of time for discussion. And I think it probably would work better if we had the questions after each presentation rather than wait for the two presentations to finish. Is that okay with both of you?
Fine.
Is that okay?
Yes.
Okay. So, Lynn, would you like to go first?
Yes.
I am Maëlle Leroux, so I'm a PhD student at University of Denmark. I am both in the history department and the modern languages and applied linguistics school. I'm originally an historian, so I did my research previously on gender history and then the representations of the Easter Rising. So this is going to be part of my main research project with it, which is representations of Irish figures in UK channel in general. So this is a case study. My research questions focus mainly on how the Capuchin Annual is part of building a national narrative in Ireland between 1930 and 1977. So how the Catholic intelligentsia and the Capuchin Franciscans played a role in that. So I use history and social linguistic methods for that. So I'm still new to social linguistic methods and to digital humanities, so sorry about that if there is any issue. So in general, I will use a case study approach to my research. So the Capuchin Annual, it was published between 1930 and 1977 by the Capuchin Franciscans. So they are a Catholic order. They are based in Church Street in Dublin, the archives are there if you need to go there. So the Capuchin Annual was first published to be a missionary journal, and then it took a more cultural and artistic and also historical turn. It's known by scholars to have held nationalist views, especially some of you might be familiar with the 1966 issue, which commemorated the Easter Rising. And so there are 44 issues in all, because some of them were published for 2 years. And it was digitized in 2016, and it's available online, so this is the link if you want to go there. It was digital using the OCR technology, but it's never perfect, this kind of thing. So if you use the web search engine, which can be pretty good, but sometimes it's not working, just to warn you. So my methodology. So I use cultural history, but understood as the French definition, which is a bit different. So using Pascal Aulet's definition, cultural history is a social history that focuses on the symbolical phenomena, and therefore it is a social history of representations. So it is known as well history of representations in France, and this is what I'm using. So it is based on post-structuralism philosophy, and it can be linked to the what is known as a linguistic turn in history. So we use language analysis to determine the patterns of historical representations. So also, since I use, since I use digital sources, I use digital humanities. So, also known sometimes as digital history because it's applied to historical sources or computational history. So I use text mining and digital tools for textual analysis to analyze the sources. It's based on social linguistics. I use corpus linguistics because I will build corpuses, corpora from the Capuchin annual. So those are scientific methods, and it's good to have that sometimes. So this is an interdisciplinary project combining methodology and methods from history and social linguistics. So today, with the unseen voices theme, I was interested in studying the absence of women in the Capuchin annual. So gender is a main criterion in history of representation research, and the same Pascal Ory as before mentions that gender history and history of representations are similar and they share the same methodology. Gender is a framework in my research. The Capuchin annual is a mainly masculine order, and the Irish nationalist history was mainly masculine until the late 20th century. So my first focus was on masculinities. But we can't really understand the construction of masculinity without actually looking at femininity and all the absence of of women figure. So the question for this paper was, how do you analyze the absence in history? It's probably more difficult than to actually analyze the presence. So even with scientific methods, it's really difficult. And it's a long-term project, so this is just one part of it. So I found it easier to start with the figures who are not absent, the figures that we actually can find in the Capuchin annual, and try to understand why these figures are here and which aspects of them is represented or which is not. So today I'm only going to talk about one of them, so Constance Markiewicz. So why on the earth? That can be a legitimate question. So first of all, she's a figure who's familiar to me because in my previous research on the representations of the East Horizon, there were representations of her, and if there was only one woman who was mentioned, it was her. So, also it started for me as a case study of her representations, but also Mrs. P.S. representation. But I found that it was really too complex when it came to analyzing the sources, because it was at least two different case studies. I still did the corpus, the representations of the three women. So it was 330,000 words, so that's very huge. And so I decided to do a small corpus for just the Countess Markiewicz. So I made interpretations following what I found, which might be challenged if you disagree with me. And they might also change when I actually find different things. So just a small presentation. So just in case you're not familiar with her, Constance Georgina Gorbuth was born in 1868 and she died in 1927. She came from a Protestant Anglo-Irish family from Sligo, and she married the Count Markiewicz, which she met in Paris. So she was a labor activist involved in the 1913 lockout. She was a feminist, she was a revolutionary, so a very important figure of the East Rising. She participated in the creation of the FINA. She was involved in Comme un Amant. She was the first woman elected in the British Parliament in 1988. And she was also the first woman who was a member of a minister cabinet in Europe. So we can say she's quite a woman and quite a figure. So this picture actually appears four times in the Capuchin Annual, and it is actually four out of the five individual pictures of her. So the methodology for this case study, so as I mentioned, I'm combining methodology of Israeli representations and cult linguistics. So first I selected the text with references to Contos Markovits. So there were 82 occurrences in all, which is not a lot. And there were 66 mentions of her in articles and 16 in pictures. I created the corpus with the text, including the picture captions. So the total is 3,000 words. So there were 32 original articles and 26 identified authors. Five of the authors were women, which is nearly 20% and is actually a good ratio because, for example, in the 1966 issue, there are only 11% of women authors. We can compare with, so I did the same research for Patrick Pierce at some points, and well, there were technical issues, but there were at least 615 occurrences of Patrick Pierce in the Capuchin Annual, so that's not the same kind of numbers. So after that, I used analysis tab to determine the criteria and the interesting patterns, which is a methodology coming from Israel representations. And then I used corpus analysis tools, like Sketch and Shine and Fluent tools. Today, I'm mainly going to talk about the Fluent tools findings. So it's available online if anyone wants to use it. I use the word cloud because it allows to determine the words that are more used in the corpus. So here it's a large number of words, so it's not really. The words were similar to the criteria found in the analysis tab. So I needed something more precise, and this is what I found with 25 words. So of course there is Contos and Markovits because it's the main denomination for. But there were also other interesting things. For example, Dublin was mentioned a lot. Also Valera for the Valera, which was interesting. We see Labour, 1916, Irish. There is also elected, death, and yeah. Then I worked with other tools to show the links between the words, which was good to see the patterns. So. I found interesting the fact that she was called Madam quite often. It's in pink here. It's not a common denomination. It's actually a French denomination. And so I looked in other corpora, and in English it's either used by or for French people mainly. So I wondered if maybe it could be because she spent time in France, but it's still not usual. You would not call James Joyce Monsieur Joyce because he spent time in Paris. So maybe it's because of her gender. So there are 14 occurrences of Madame, 9 by men and 4 by women, and 2 unknown. So it's not a significant difference from normal gender ratio. So there is another hypothesis which is harder to verify. So the name Madame would be used as a social and gender marker to identify her as a woman from higher society. So in a way, it would remind people of her status, but maybe not in a positive way, because using a French word would put a distance and nearly identify her as a foreigner. The word charming appears twice in the corpus. One in the picture caption and the other one in an article. So I tried to look at word links using Fluent tools again to see if there were any patterns. So here I tried to see what was used with charm in it, so charming, charm, and so I mainly noticed that it was linked with beautiful. Beautiful? So I did the same with beautiful. So there were very interesting words that showed up. So first, so there were mentions that actually had no link with her directly. I checked them. So what's the words I found interesting were impetuous, lovable, and bubbling. Now, if I read to you, Thomas MacDonough was gay and debonair in his grey-green uniform. James Connolly's eyes were twinkling. Patrick Pearce was bubbling over with high spirits, as well as were all the others in the room. Or Mrs. Pearce was bubbling over with enthusiasm and confidence in Ireland's future. So does it sound right? Because that's not the actual text. So if you change the name Patrick Pearce and Mrs. Pearce with Countess Markiewicz, you have the actual quotations. Now, if someone says to you at the end of the conference, you were bubbling today, not going to be happy about it. This is not a nice word. So there are three occurrences of bubbling used in reference to Countess Markiewicz in the corpus. So it's a really strange word. The word is gendered, first. Patrick Pearce doesn't bubble because he's a man, and neither do James Connolly or any other man. It's only associated with women. There is also a social connotation. We can use it for Markiewicz because she's a higher society woman, but we wouldn't be able to use it for a lady from the working class, for example. Oh, well, yeah, a woman from the working class. There is this idea of being idle. She makes bubbles. She's not producing anything. She's effervescent. She's moving a lot, but there is nothing that comes out of it. So I was curious to see if it actually came up from anyone else, if maybe Patrick Pearce was bubbling at some point. So I used Kirchner, sorry. Oh, yeah, so this is what it showed when I used that. So, I spirits, Madame Beautiful. And so I did, so in the 330,000 words, there were only three occurrences. And it was just Mrs. Markiewicz. Miss Markiewicz. So I found that interesting. also, a very interesting fact was the three articles were all written by women. So all of these women were involved in as revolutionaries in the East Rising. So it's Betsy Gray, Elish Nihora, and Kathleen McKenna. So the possible interpretation would be that revolutionary women who wrote in the Capuchin Annual were not necessarily feminists, and they did not approve of the involvement of Markiewicz in the feminist movements. So they had to mention her action because, well, she was there in the East Rising, they can't forget to mention her. But they used the word bubbling to diminish her action in a way compared to the men. So, next. So, Markiewicz was born in a Protestant family, as I mentioned before. So, when I started this research project in general, one of my main questions was how the Capuchin Annual and the Catholic Intelligentsia, the authors, would represent the non-Catholics. So, for example, Connolly or Bofton or Markiewicz. So, there are actually three mentions of her converting to Catholicism in 1916. So, here we can see Easter, for example, which is a reference to the Easter Rising. So it mentions either in picture captions or in biographies of her. So all three are actually of unknown authors. So my guess is that the editor wrote the biography and the picture captions, and the editor was the Capuchin Franciscan. So that would be logical because, well, he wanted to mention that she was Catholic. And an interesting picture caption was in under a picture of Michael Mullen. So it is said that his good example influenced Countess Markiewicz to become a Catholic. I found that really strange. So there is also, so she's mentioned sometimes as a family woman in traditional feminine values. So for example, in 1966, in an article by Manix Joyce about 1916 in Kerry in Limerick, so, Ford had breakfast with Clark, Connolly, and Kent, and was waited on by Countess Markiewicz. So, this is the only mention of Countess Markiewicz in this article. I was really surprised to find this, especially since it's actually the second occurrence that mentions Malkovich and breakfast. But so my first question was, why would they mention who served them at breakfast? Because who cares who served you at breakfast? It's not really that important. And also, would Malkovich actually serve breakfast to fellow revolutionaries and not eat with them? So would she actually just serve them? So there are a few interpretations to that. So maybe saying that she served breakfast was a way to put a hierarchy, so to say she is a woman, so she does not eat with the men, she serves them. And again, there is the problem that she was there, so they can't forget her, but maybe the author does not want to represent her as equal to men. Maybe it's also a way to put Ford on top of the hierarchy because Malkovich was serving him. There is the fact that Manning's Joyce was not a witness to this event, so I'm wondering if the sources maybe would have mentioned who served the breakfast, or if they mentioned maybe that Countess Malkovich was around, but Manning's Joyce assumed that she had served them. So there is a really important idea of Catholic tradition in the Capuchin Annual. It's emphasized here, so with the Catholic and the breakfast, but also by the use of a picture of Malkovich and the family with the caption, a charming picture of Countess Malkovich, president of Kumandamon, with her daughter and stepson. So most accounts actually say that she was not that close to the children. It's a way to present her as a traditional woman, the way she is supposed to be. So I got interested in her because she's a revolutionary figure. So this book cloud mentions, so actually this word cloud shows that she's only mentioned as a revolutionary figure to say she was an artist, she was a revolutionary artist. And the only other time she is mentioned as a figure, a revolutionary figure, was in a quotation of newspapers mentioning that she was to blame for the burning of the town and the Easter Rising. So someone in the article quoting that newspaper. So next one. So after 1916, because I found it really interesting. So college reference to College Greens, commandant's battalion reference, all reference to the Easter Rising. Ceremonies is because she was there are a lot of picture captions of her during commemorations. But I didn't really understand why death. That was interesting. So, next one. So I found that Liz Wertling doesn't mention her actual death. She died in 1927 and not in 1916. So there are seven occurrences mentioning her death sentence in 1916, but only two mention her going to prison. They say it was commuted, and it's usually stopped there. They don't mention her after that. They don't mention her actions. So it's as if her life had stopped in 1916. So some of the occurrences are really strange. So Manning's Joyce again in 1963 in an article about De Valera, so when talking about the general elections in 1918. Since both De Valera and the Countess had been sentenced to death for their parts in the Rising, their appearance on an Erfurt, I'm not sure, platform at that stirring period of Irish history very naturally have rise to a wonderful display of enthusiasm. So then it goes on to describe who was actually elected in the election, so De Valera, obviously. But it does not mention Malkovich again. So this is interesting because the link is made between De Valera and the Countess on the status of survivor of the death penalty. But the author does not want to say that she had a political career after that, like De Valera. And yeah, this is the breakfast author, if you want to remember. So I found that very few authors talk about what she did between 1916 and her death in 1927. And so I thought that maybe it could be they had wanted her to die in 1916, because she was saved by her gender, by the fact that she was a woman. But after that, she still refused to act according to the gender norms of the time. So they would have preferred maybe to have her as a martyr in 1916, which is actually mentioned in one occurrence. And this way, she would have saved them the embarrassment of being herself and being a woman in politics. There is actually, in a book published in 1967 by Jacqueline van Voorhis, she mentions that had she been executed in 1916, she would have taken a place among the martyred saints of nationalism. So she's, that seems to correlate what I found. So there are also quite a few mentions of her uniform. So four or five of the individual pictures are of her in her uniform. So there are four mentions of her uniform in summary, funny ones. So one by Liam O'Brien in 1966. I do not count among the women Countess Markovic's picturesque in her own special uniform. So this is actually a really interesting article, because especially for this part, because its description of her is quite positive in general. But still, it does not consider her as a woman, because she does not respect the gender norm criteria. She's not a man either. She's something in between. And here, it's because of her uniform and because she has weapons. She's a fighter. And so there are two other interesting mentions. So both of them are actually by Catherine McKenna. It was not easy to believe that such a delicate feminine creature had worn military uniform and fought in 1916. So she mentions that in 1970. And then in 1971, and the widows and relatives of the martyrs, Mrs. Pierce and her daughter, Margaret, Countess Plunkett, Mrs. McCurtain, Madame Gunn McBride, Mary McSweeney, Mrs. O'Callaghan, Mrs. Kent, and beautiful, lovable, impetuous Countess Markovic in a faded volunteer green uniform. She was not a wife or she was not a family of a revolutionary, she was one herself. And here she is said as a plus one, as a wife of a family half, instead of being described as a revolutionary and all. And she's the only one with description in this. They don't mention how Countess Plunkett was dressed. Maybe the faded uniform could be a way to say her revolutionary days were over and she was back on the women's side. So.
Do you want to wrap up?
Yeah, I will, quickly. So she is not mentioned many times as a political career is not mentioned many times. There are only seven occurrences of her as Minister for Labour in the first Dáil, and three only mention her election in 1918, so first in 1940. Incidentally, she was the first woman to be elected at the British parliamentary election. So there are two occurrences in the same article in 1968. She was the only woman elected in that election, the first woman ever elected in Britain. So there are only two authors who talk about her election in 1918. And a reminder, four people talked about her uniform. So here, what I found interesting was the word British. They don't mention that she was the first member of cabinet in Ireland. They only associate her election with something British and not Irish. So there are many more possible things to say about the representations of Countess Markovic in the Capuchin Annual. So the possible interpretation of her presence, but the absence of more women in the Capuchin Annual, was that she was impossible to avoid because of her role, but also because of her social class. And her involvement in general, and that maybe she was so fascinating, she was a fascinating figure. And people, so I think maybe some of the authors tried, maybe not consciously, to diminish her and her actions and to ease her provocative aspects. She is a figure of Irish nationalism, and when talking about that period, they could not avoid her. But it gives a good idea as to why women were not represented in Gavitch's annual, and also which women were. Only a guess, but maybe I would find in the representations, I will find mainly nationalist women who follow the general gender norms of their time, and none of them would be a character like the Countess. So, so again, the question of how can we study the absence. So here, I will use this, and then I will compare this to secondary sources to see what actually is missing in these representations. So we'll do that at some point soon. Thank you.